Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
Our press secretary gave alternative facts to that.
My goal in this deposition was to be truthful, but not particularly helpful.
Welcome to Unspun, the podcast that makes you better at finding the truth. The way people get news is changing. It used to be that there were many reporters who would research stories and write articles, but now politicians and famous people share information directly with you on social media and the internet. That means you find out things fast, but it's up to you to make sure the information's actually accurate. And newsmakers don't always do their part. The temptation to manipulate information is strong. They bend the truth to deceive so that they can avoid accountability, so that they can advance their agendas. When you recognize these agendas, you can sometimes find out what's real. And we're at a crossroads where anyone can share anything online, so it's important to sharpen your critical thinking skills. Finding that deception before it goes viral is pretty much a survival skill now, and we're going to do it together. Let's get unspun. Hello, truth seekers, and welcome to this week's Unspun. In today's episode, I'm looking at rage baiting. It's an extension of an ancient model of communication, and it's used to pull both people and algorithms into promoting bad ideas. Before we get started, I wanted to thank all of you who've taken the time to write to the pod with your questions and ideas. I do this for you, and it's great to have a chance to hear from you directly about what's working and even what I can do better. You can always reach out to me on Blue Sky, where I'm Dr. Sturge, D-R-S-T-U-R-G, or at theunspunpodcast@gmail.com. Okay, let's get unspun. Before I get into today's situation, I need to take you back a little bit. Well, a lot. Way, way back to ancient Greece, where a very smart guy named Aristotle came up with three ways of engaging an audience with your ideas. He was a Greek, so there are Greek names, logos, ethos, and pathos. And I have a few examples, so let's go through them for this week's warm-up. Logos is the same root word as logic, and that really describes this approach to communication. It means that you're combining your objective evidence with carefully structured thoughts that lead to your conclusion. Have a listen to this example.
We have therefore in this island today a very large and powerful military force. This force includes all our best trained troops and our finest troops, including scores of thousands of those who have already measured their quality against the Germans and found themselves at no disadvantage. We have under arms at the present time in this island over a million and a quarter men. Behind these, we have the local defense volunteers, numbering 500,000, only a portion of whom, however, are yet armed with rifles or other firearms. We have incorporated into our defense forces every man for whom we have a weapon. We expect very large additions to our weapons in the near future.
That was Winston Churchill speaking to the people of Britain in what was called his finest hour speech. Now, this was a speech trying to call the British people to continue fighting World War II after the fall of France. He's trying to motivate the public to endure what he knew was going to be a really tough struggle against the Nazis. But notice the logic that he uses here. In the speech, he's just acknowledged that the loss of France was very costly for the British. But in the clip that you just heard, he notes that they do still have a powerful military. Not only that, but they're preparing to even increase their size as they can increase their number of weapons and arm more people. This is a logos argument. He's presenting evidence that the British are a strong force that can eventually prevail. A second kind of argument is an ethos argument. An ethos argument focuses on the credibility of the person who is making it. Ethos is another Greek word, and it means character. And authors and speakers can achieve ethos by proving that they are of good character, right? They're a strong source of accurate information. There can be different ways of doing this. For example, you can show that you have firsthand experience, or you can show that you have education that makes you a master worthy of speaking on the topic. You can also focus on your own goodness as the person giving the message. You know, that you have the best interests of the listener at heart. Here's another example.
In 1963, when I was born, I was counted among the flora and fauna, not among the citizens of this country. Now, you will hear things tonight. You will hear people say, but you've done well. Yes, I have. And I'm proud of it. And why have I done well? I've done well because of who has come before me. My father, who lost the tips of three fingers working in sawmills to put food on our table because he was denied an education. My grandfather, who served to fight wars for this country when he was not yet a citizen and came back to a segregated land where he couldn't even share a drink with his digger mates in the pub because he was black. My great-grandfather, who was jailed for speaking his language to his grandson, my father, jailed for it. My grandfather on my mother's side, who married a white woman who reached out to Australia, lived on the fringes of town until the police came, put a gun to his head, bulldozed his tin humpy, and ran over the graves of the three children he buried there. That's the Australian dream. I have succeeded in spite of the Australian dream, not because of it, and I've succeeded because of those people. You might hear tonight, but you have white blood in you. And if the white blood in me was here tonight, my grandmother, she would tell you of how she was turned away from a hospital giving birth to her first child because she was giving birth to the child of a black person. The Australian dream. We're better than this.
That was Stan Grant. He is an Australian of Aboriginal descent, an author, and a popular TV journalist who covers Indigenous affairs, among other things. And he's speaking at a public debate to argue for the topic, Racism is Destroying the Australian Dream. In his argument, he talks about the way colonization impacts Indigenous Australians. And what's interesting here is how Grant sets up this argument. He's using ethos. He's telling the audience that his and his family's lived experiences qualify him to speak on the topic of racism in the country. A third type of argument is pathos. Pathos is an appeal to emotion. The speaker might use language or imagery to make the audience feel something. Maybe sadness or anger or joy or fear. The emotional connection can help persuade the listener. So here's an example to listen to.
You're absolutely right, Fareed. The pretexts are utterly ludicrous. This action is utter madness. It is a betrayal of America's closest friend, of your ally, your neighbor, your best partner in the whole world. It is an act of economic warfare, and the president was clear just this morning that it is a direct attack on our sovereignty. And I have to tell you, Fareed, Americans are going to be astonished by the Canadian response.
That was Canada's Chrystia Freeland, who is running to replace Justin Trudeau as prime minister. She's talking about the tariffs between the U.S. and Canada, and she's using pathos here. You can feel like it's a personal thing. Why would we want to hurt our neighbors? So we have logos, ethos, and pathos. Three ideas from an ancient Greek that still affect how we communicate today. I need to take a quick break, but when I come back, we're going to see how everyone, from activists to politicians to even trusted news outlets, are weaponizing pathos to help keep you clicking. I'll be right back. Welcome back. Let's talk about rage baiting. You've probably seen it. You've maybe even fallen for it without realizing it. Rage baiting, or sometimes they call it rage farming, is essentially a manipulative tactic designed to get under your skin. The goal? To make you so angry, so outraged, that you can't help but engage. And when you engage, whether it's liking, commenting, sharing, or even just hate watching, you are feeding the beast. Here's how it works. Content creators, whether they're individuals or companies or political groups, they deliberately create posts and headlines and memes or even just comment threads that are just begging for a reaction. And it's not subtle either. You know, think about that headline you saw last week that made your blood boil, or that post that felt like it was personally attacking you and your values. That's rage baiting. So why do they do it? It's not just to annoy you, it's about engagement. Social media platforms reward posts that generate intense emotional responses, whether that's positive or negative. That's because when you engage, it boosts visibility. The posts get more likes, more shares, more eyeballs, and that means more ad money, more followers, sometimes even more political support. But rage baiting isn't just about engagement, it can also be a weapon. It's often used to disrupt targets, whether that's an activist group, a politician, it could even be an individual like you or me. The idea is to put people on the defensive and force them to respond, which takes their time and their energy and even their focus away from their goals. I mean, think about it. If you're constantly battling trolls or responding to inflammatory comments, how much time are you really spending on the work that matters to you? This is important, and here's where it gets really dangerous. It's not just about provoking anger. Rage baiting is often tangled up with misinformation. You know, conspiracy theories, half-truths, outright lies. They're all used to fuel that emotional response. Because when you are angry or outraged, you are less likely to fact-check, and you're more likely to share. And so that's part of the manipulation. And while this tactic can be really successful for content creators in the short term, financially, you know, politically, maybe even just in terms of clout, there's also consequences. For us, the consumers of this content, there's an emotional toll. I mean, think about how you feel after spending an hour doom scrolling through angry posts or Facebook feeds. You're exhausted, right? Maybe even a little numb. You know, that's not just a one-off feeling. Over time, this constant exposure to outrage can desensitize. It makes us polarized. It makes us skeptical of legitimate advocacy or legitimate news. And it makes important causes seem to be less credible. It's a vicious cycle, and platforms know it. But they also know that it keeps us glued to our screens. So how about some examples? Let's start with a moment that changed the world forever, September 11th, 2001. It's hard to overstate the emotional weight of that day. The terrorist attacks didn't just devastate lives. They left an entire nation grappling with fear and grief and just this overwhelming sense of vulnerability. But beyond that collective trauma, there were also ripple effects, ones that shaped the political landscape in ways that you might not have thought about. In the days and weeks after September 11th, anxiety was everywhere. And it wasn't just fear of another attack. It was this deeper, almost primal sense of insecurity. There were news stories following up on the attacks, and they amplified those feelings. They showed repeated video of the Twin Towers falling, and there were constant headlines warning of new threats. And that makes sense. When we're bombarded with vivid reminders of danger, our emotions will take the wheel. Anxiety and fear and even anger, they all kind of come to the surface. But here's where it gets really interesting. These emotional responses didn't just shape how people felt, they influenced how they thought. In particular, research showed they changed how Americans viewed leadership. After 9/11, researchers found that there was a noticeable shift in political attitudes. People started prioritizing strength and security. And here's the kicker. That shift came with a specific consequence for women in politics. In the wake of those attacks, many Americans became less willing to vote for a woman for president. Why? Because there's this perception, you know, whether accurate or not, that men are better equipped to handle defense and military issues. It's the tough on terror mindset, and it played right into these gender stereotypes. So think about what that means. A single event, even a catastrophic one, reshaped how voters thought about leadership and security. And it wasn't based on policies or qualifications, but on their emotional reaction to a moment of crisis. And these emotions, that fear, that anxiety, that vulnerability, it stayed around a long time after the dust settled. And really, this is the power of emotion in media. When an event as monumental as September 11th happens, the way it's covered can influence not only how you feel, but how you make decisions. These decisions don't always happen in the rational part of your brain. They're shaped by the emotions that dominate the moment. So let's talk about another example, one of the most infamous ones, about media manipulation in recent history, the Internet Research Agency, or IRA. If you've never heard of it, the IRA wasn't just some run-of-the-mill troll farm. It was an organization that was established by Russian authorities in 2013, and it had one very clear mission: to figure out the dividing lines in society and to use that to cause chaos. By 2015, the IRA had zeroed in on a strategy, one that focused almost entirely on social media. And they did try targeting many groups, but the Black community in the United States was one of the most heavily targeted, and this was not accidental. The IRA realized that there were long-standing tensions between the Black community and law enforcement, and so they saw an opportunity to exploit those emotions for their own agenda. Consider this. There was a fake Facebook account called Blacktivist that was operated by the IRA, and it managed to amass 360,000 followers. So to put that into perspective, it had 59,000 more followers than the actual Black Lives Matter account at the time. Yeah, you heard me right. That's an entirely fake operation, orchestrated by a foreign government, and it captured more attention than the legitimate movement it was pretending to support. How did it work? Well, the IRA didn't just post inflammatory content, they were really strategic. They mixed messages of love, pride, and empowerment with narratives of victimization and defiance. Some posts celebrated Black identity and reinforced self and community pride, while others amplified those feelings of vulnerability and being disillusioned. And so this was a calculated choice, right, to build trust by evoking positive emotions and then use that trust to push more divisive and emotionally charged content. And those tactics didn't stop online. The IRA went as far as promoting real-life events, blending their disinformation campaigns with legitimate activism. I mean, imagine, you get invited to a rally or an event and you think it's organized by an activist group, and you later find out it was organized by a Russian troll farm. So the goal wasn't just to spread disinformation, it was also to blur the lines between real and fake, you know, to sow distrust and confusion. And at its core, the strategy was about emotional manipulation. They crafted content that really resonated deeply, leaning into the digital ecosystem's ability to amplify those messages and make them go viral. And it worked. And what's chilling about this is how effective it was. And it exposed the vulnerabilities of the social platforms that we use every day. Platforms that you'd think are connecting us are instead tools for division and being exploited by other governments. Around the same time was the lead up to one of the most consequential votes in modern British history, the Brexit referendum. This wasn't just a political campaign, it was a clash of emotions. So on one side you had fear, and on the other you had anger. And the media? They were amplifying both, turning this battle into a full-blown emotional tug of war. Why would they do this? Well, remember, media are a business, and this business makes money when people use it, because they sell your views and your clicks to advertisers. The Remain campaign, which you could call Project Fear, leaned heavily on fear-based messaging. Their strategy was pretty easy, warn voters about the chaos that would follow if Britain left the European Union. Politicians in the Remain camp warned about risks to British jobs and exports and the economy, and there were headlines like, Brexit fears wipe, you know, £100 billion off the FTSE 100 in 4 days. That's a London stock market. That was not subtle. And the message was that leaving the EU would be a disaster, and honestly, fear can be a powerful motivator, because when people feel at risk, they tend to play it safe. The Leave campaign had a different tactic. If Remain was Project Fear, Leave was Project Anger, and they tapped into frustration and resentment, especially toward the EU and toward, you know, what they called the political elite. They had some really fiery rhetoric. It was designed to rile people up. So there were tweets about those mad EU rules, like one supposedly preventing cuts to steel energy costs, and speeches that accused establishment politicians of dragging their heels. It was just a plain and simple us versus them. And here's the thing about anger. It's energizing. It gives people a sense of purpose, a reason to fight back. And that's why, even after the Leave campaign technically won the referendum, that anger didn't go away. Some Leave politicians doubled down, expressing their outrage at the idea that elites might somehow fail to, quote, deliver Brexit. All this time, the media played both sides. So news outlets were quick to highlight the dangers of Brexit, which fueled the fear narrative, but they also amplified the anger, giving space to the Leave camp's anti-EU sentiments. And as the referendum got closer, something interesting happened. Fear in the public started to decline. It might be that people got desensitized to these warnings, which does sometimes happen with fear as a motivator, or it's possible they just stopped believing them. Either way, with fear out of the way, anger took the center stage, and we all know how that story ended. Anger won, the Leave campaign won, and Britain left the EU. But what's fascinating is that this wasn't just a political moment. It was a masterclass in emotional manipulation. Fear and anger and outrage, these emotions kind of drove the conversation. They shaped that public opinion and ultimately decided the outcome. So you may be wondering, how exactly does this emotional manipulation work? What is it about the language of trolls, especially those who spread misinformation, that can hook an audience even if it's just for a moment? Researchers have studied this, and it turns out that the way that they craft their message isn't random, it's deliberate. So let's break it down. First, there's the psycholinguistic side of things, and that's just a fancy way of saying that they use specific language techniques, things like emotional tone and style of wording, to influence how we perceive their messages. And the fascinating part is that research finds these techniques are different depending on the types of trolls doing the talking. Take partisan trolls, for instance. When they tweet about something like vaccines, their language tends to be more sophisticated than you might think. They use words that show thinking, addressing causes, effects, or even the broader social implications of the topic. It's not just a vaccines are bad post. It's more like they're trying to sound thoughtful and informed and even reasonable. but it gets really interesting when you think about emotion. You would expect trolls spreading misinformation to go heavy on fear or anger, right? And sometimes they do. But partisan trolls in particular often lean into positive emotions when they're framing misinformation. They'll phrase things in a way that make their false claims sound like common sense, you know, something you'd naturally agree with. For example, instead of saying vaccines are dangerous, they might say, we all want best for our families, so why not question what's in that vaccine? It feels less aggressive and more reassuring, you know, kind of like they're on your side. And then there is pronoun usage. This is something you might not think about, but it plays a big role in how we relate to the message. Right-leaning trolls are more likely to use words like we, language that creates a sense of group identity. They're building a sense of belonging, you know, we're all in this together. Left-leaning trolls tend to favor me language, which emphasizes individuality and uniqueness. You know, they might say, here's why I think this matters. It's two totally different approaches, but both designed to appeal to their audience's target values. And here's the twist. Despite all this careful crafting, the thoughtfulness, the emotional framing, the me-we pronouns, misinformation tweets from trolls don't necessarily perform well in terms of likes, comments, or shares. In fact, most of these tweets get relatively little engagement. Researchers have thought about why this could be. It could be that users see the content for what it is, you know, problematic, and they distance themselves from it. It could be that they pick the wrong topics and the networks just don't engage in the ways they hoped. But think about this. Even if the engagement numbers are low, the trolls have still accomplished something. Because it's not always about going viral, it's about planting a seed. So maybe that post doesn't blow up, but it still reaches a handful of people who see it, and they believe it, and they start spreading the misinformation in their own circles, maybe in a WhatsApp message, or in an email, or even offline. So you can think of it as like a slow burn and not an explosion. And ultimately, what this shows is that trolls are more sophisticated than we give them credit for. They're not just spamming all caps rants, they're tailoring their language to fit the audience. They're leveraging emotion, how you feel with a group, and even subtle positivity to make the messages stick. And while that doesn't always lead to massive engagement, it can still be enough to nudge the conversation and even sometimes the culture in a different direction. All right, now that we've talked about how people use emotional content to manipulate and engage, let's shift our focus to the role of technology, specifically algorithms. Algorithms are the invisible hands behind the curtain, deciding what you see, what you don't, and how far a single post can spread. And the impact can be massive. Here's the thing about algorithms. They're usually designed to prioritize engagement. Platforms like Facebook and Twitter and TikTok and Instagram and YouTube, they all have one primary goal, which is keeping you on the platform. The longer you're there, the more ads they can show you and the more money they make. And what keeps us scrolling? Emotion. Posts that evoke anger, joy, surprise, they're much more likely to grab your attention. And this means that the posts that are most likely to provoke a reaction, whether it's a like, a comment, or a share, are the ones that the algorithm amplifies. And when it comes to emotional manipulation, this creates a perfect storm. We can take rage farming, for instance. Imagine someone posts something intentionally inflammatory, right? They're trying to provoke outrage. Even if you reply to it with your own angry comment, even if you refute it, guess what? You have just helped amplify it. The algorithm doesn't care if your engagement is positive or negative, it just sees the numbers. And it doesn't stop there. Social media platforms also facilitate something called emotional contagion. Basically, if you see posts filled with outrage or joy, these emotions can spread. It's almost contagious, like a digital mood swing. They're not just amplifying individual posts, they're amplifying these broader emotional waves across entire networks. And then, of course, there's personalization. Algorithms are constantly tweaking your feed based on what you engage with. Over time, you see less and less content that challenges your beliefs and more that reinforces them. And this can feel comforting, you know, like the algorithm gets you, but it's also really dangerous. Because when you're only exposed to one side of an issue, it becomes harder to understand or even tolerate opposing perspectives. And sometimes the algorithms are even more overt in steering the conversation. Take Facebook, for example. At one point, their algorithm started scoring emoji reactions like the angry face or the heart higher than just likes. Why would they do this? It boosts engagement. But the unintended consequence is that controversial or outrage-inducing posts, posts that get people worked up enough to use those reactions, are rewarded and amplified even more. On top of this, there's what's called negativity bias. So people are naturally drawn to more negative stimuli. We pay more attention to bad news than we do good news. Algorithms pick up on this. So posts that generate anger or outrage often perform better, they get amplified, and this creates a feedback loop of negativity. Maybe this is why you feel so bad if you're on your phone for an hour. So what are the implications? They're not great. Algorithms that prioritize emotional engagement often end up bringing up divisive content more often and more prominently. And there's been multiple research studies that have shown this. This can hurt our ability to talk to people we disagree with because, you know, let's be honest, it's hard to have a thoughtful conversation when outrage is dominating how we feel. And then there's the spread of misinformation. Since algorithms reward engagement, they often amplify misleading or false content because it gets the clicks and shares. And in the most extreme cases, this digital outrage machine has had real-world consequences. One kind of horrifying example is the role Facebook's algorithms played in the Rohingya genocide in Myanmar. By amplifying hate speech and divisive content, it fueled violence on the ground. So the bottom line, algorithms aren't neutral. We've talked about the people behind disinformation and the technology that amplifies it, but what about the rest of us, you know, the audience? How does all this manipulation affect how we think or feel or even behave? Here's something surprising. Disinformation doesn't just shape what you think or what you believe, it can actually change your behavior. Researchers have found effects even things as small as how you type on a keyboard or how long you focus on something. And these changes may seem unimportant, but when you zoom out, they can kind of cascade into bigger, more significant things. We'll start with something simple, typing speed. Studies have shown that if you're exposed to fake news, it unconsciously influences your motor functions, like how fast you tap on a keyboard. In one experiment, just a short exposure to fake news altered participants' typing speed, even though when they were trying to type as fast as they could. Think about that. Disinformation isn't just changing what you believe, it's affecting your physical behavior in ways you don't even know. And then there's attention span. Emotionally charged disinformation, especially the kind designed to promote outrage, has a way of grabbing and holding your attention. When something holds your attention, you're more likely to stay on the platform. It's not just about the content, it's about how it hooks you or it keeps you locked in. And here's where it gets even more interesting. These small changes, like typing speed or attention span, they don't exist in isolation. They feed into larger, more complex behaviors. So disinformation can work on an unconscious level and bypass your rational decision-making processes. It can change your implicit attitudes, these automatic feelings you have toward people or ideas or groups. And those attitudes influence your actions. For example, disinformation can create emotional associations. Over time, these associations can influence how you interpret new information, how you vote, how you interact with other people. You may cross the street to avoid somebody in a red hat or in an indivisible shirt. And the more emotionally charged the disinformation, the stronger this effect. On an individual level, it may also mean that your decision to believe or even share something isn't as rational as you think it is. On a societal level, that effect can be enormous. Disinformation influences voting decisions, it manipulates public opinion, and it has even incited violence. And all of this challenges our idea of individual autonomy. When disinformation can unconsciously influence your behavior, it brings up a really tough question. How much of our decision-making is really our own? And if we don't have that autonomy, what does that mean for a functioning society? Now, I will say it's not all doom and gloom. There are ways to push back against this manipulation. Education, especially media literacy and critical thinking, can go a long way in helping people recognize and question misinformation. To an extent, fact-checking systems and validation tools can help detect and correct false claims. We do need interdisciplinary collaboration to address this problem, and that's something that is getting a little bit more attention. One of the most important things we can do, though, is to become more aware of how disinformation uses emotional manipulation. When you feel triggered by a piece of content, if it makes you angry, if it makes you scared, take a moment to pause. Ask yourself, why am I feeling this way? Is this content designed to provoke me? And if so, how can I step back and evaluate it critically? It's not just about protecting ourselves from bad information. It's about protecting our autonomy, our democracy, even our ability to make informed decisions in a world full of noise. Stay sharp out there, truth seekers. Thanks for getting Unspun with me this week. Unspun is a production of me, Amanda Sturgill, and is a proud member of the MSW Media family of podcasts. Send me your thoughts and ideas about trickery in the news on Gmail at theunspunpodcast@gmail.com. I even write back. and find this episode's show notes and more information at theunspunpodcast.substack.com. Want to learn more and get smarter? Check out my book, Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News, which is available on Amazon or your favorite online bookseller. And until next time, stay sharp, everyone.
Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-Roe anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.